We've all heard the saying, home is where the heart is. But can the houses have hearts? Maybe even souls? Can events that happen within their walls be so impactful that the houses become living entities all their own?
Welcome to You Totally Made That Up. We are a bi-weekly history podcast that tells you the wildest, craziest, nuttiest stories from yesteryear, ones that sound like somebody must have totally made them up. But they're all true, and we especially like the ones that have supernatural, paranormal, woo-woo elements, so those parts may only be true to the people who live them. We don't go for the lore says or the legend goes, though. We want dates and names and all the facts we can find. My name is Nash.
My name is Tiff.
We are your hosts. We're still talking creepy houses. Tiff gave you the lowdown on the Winchester Mystery House last time, and this time we're visiting the house where the events known as the Amityville Horror took place. You ready for this?
So ready.
All right. Before I begin, there are two parts to the story of the house I'm going to be telling you about: a horrific murder, then a purported haunting. Now, I have found that when I've heard this story, typically one of two things happens. The murder is the primary focus, or the reported haunting and the following books and movies are the primary focus. But for me, both of these events are notable parts of the house's history, and so within that, important details of both are either glossed over or misconstrued or based on flimsy sourcing altogether. And I say all that to say, even if you have heard the story, give me a chance. I suspect I just may be hitting on some things that you didn't realize. And I assure you that while this is heavy in some parts, there is some levity due to some things that I for sure had personally never heard or seen before.
I'm sold.
I'm going to do things a little differently, though. In the podcast, true crime does come up, but we're not a strictly true crime podcast. And when it does come up, we don't typically go into super detail. This one, though, like I say, I found a lot of the common elements of that part of the story that go around aren't exactly accurate. And I think many of you might find it interesting. For those of you who don't, though, what I'm going to do is I'll focus on the ghosty, haunted end of the story first, so it hooks up theme-wise with what Tiff talked about in episode 36. Then I'm going to swing back around to the true crime stuff. That way, if you want to dip after the paranormal part, go for it. So, you know, the true crime stuff, let's just call it bonus content. I take you to the United States, 30 miles outside of New York City, the south shore of Long Island, to the small town of Amityville, and to a house on 112 Ocean Avenue. Living there is the DeFeo family, Ronald and Louise DeFeo, who are both in their 40s, and their five children, Ronald Jr., 23, who we're going to refer to by his nickname Butch so as not to get things confused, Dawn, 18, Allison, 13, Mark, 12, and John Matthew, 9. It was built in 1925. They had lived there since 1965. Named the home High Hopes, and you can see that on a sign outside the house in the photo that I put in show notes. And they had remodeled it. They really put a lot into the house. They loved it. It's a Dutch colonial style, and it's 5 bedrooms, 3.5 baths, and I think like 3 floors plus attic and basement, if I recall correctly. Then it also butted up to the Long Island Canal, so there was a little dock and boathouse, in-ground pool, just a really impressive spread. The word Amity means of a peaceful, friendly nature, and that's exactly what Amityville was, peaceful, until November of 1974. The evening of the 13th, oldest son Butch discovers his family has been murdered, all 6 of them, all shot while in their beds. We're going to go into detail in the bonus content, as I said, but for now, let's just cut to the chase. Butch ultimately confesses that he did the murders late the night prior / early morning that day. There's questions as to his mental state at the time. This does not wash with the jury, and he is given 6 life sentences, specifically 25 to life, but he'll likely die in prison. All his attempts at appeals and getting parole have failed, and we'll talk about that in the bonus content too. So he's convicted, and a local journalist named Joel Martin, who covered the crime and the trial, says after Butch was sentenced, quote, "That's when I thought, and everybody else thought, that's where this horrible story would end. We never dreamed that the story would go on forever." Oh my, whatever
wow,
could he mean?
Dramatic.
Well, he ain't far off. So the home stands empty for a while. Then it was put on the market at a really low price considering what it was worth. And now enter the Lutz family. They are George and Kathy. They had just gotten married and they're in their mid-30s. And we also have Kathy's kids from a prior marriage. Danny, 9, Christopher, 7, and Missy, 5. They weren't wealthy or even well off from what I can gather. Either it wasn't noted or I just completely missed if Kathy worked. George was noted to be a self-employed surveyor, though one source called them, quote, two relative newlyweds of indeterminate employment. But anyhow, they had the three kids, so they legit needed something with space, that's true. But this large house in this location was something ordinarily completely out of their means. So this is, for real, something to consider jumping on. I can't blame them at all for considering buying it. George said in a 2003 interview on ABC that after he and Kathy viewed the house and learned of its history that, quote, we went home and we sat around as a family and discussed it, and we talked about it for quite a while, and it was decided that it would be okay. I mean, I guess there's delicate ways that you can break this to children, but hell if I know what they are. I just hope that the details weren't told to the kids, you know?
Yeah. And we joke that we had a cannibal that lives in our basement, but...
Well, yeah, of course.
You gotta tease him sometimes, but I guess maybe the circumstances of that house would be a little bit much.
Well, and it's not real, you know? They couldn't... There's not people around town that would be like, hey, heard about your cannibal situation. It's not in the newspaper. You know, you get my point.
True.
Okay.
Yeah.
December 18th, 1975, the Lutzes move in. So this is right at a year after the murders. It's noted in a few places that George was already into paranormal type stuff. Cannot confirm that for you with 100% certainty. I'll tell you where that comes from later. But we do know that Kathy was Catholic, and moving into a murder house, understandably, likely made her feel icky anyway. But then you've got that religious icing on top. So right when they move in, she has a priest come over to bless the house, one by the name of Father Ralph Pecoraro. He comes up more in a second. Now shit kicks off. They are experiencing paranormal, supernatural, fill in the blank with your term of choice, events, and here are but a few of their claims. Dramatic temperature changes, slime oozing from various places, though this was later said by George to be exaggerated, the amount that is, noises and scrapes and bangs and footsteps, doors ripped from the hinges, something unseen touching them. Kathy saw herself as an old woman in the mirror. Something pinning them to the bed while trying to sleep or after waking up. More on this in a moment. George finds a surprise extra room in the basement that's painted red. Waking up at 3:15 a.m., the supposed time of the murders. More on that in the bonus content. Furniture moving around. Though at another point, George denied this, so you got me on where that came from. A persistent stench. Which, let me pause here, I don't necessarily think this was false, depending on how the cleaning went, because back then they didn't have the type of professional crime scene cleaners as they do now, nor I imagine advanced products and tools and methods, and those bodies were in there for about 18 hours, give or take, and wallpaper, I mean, hell, walls in general, and carpets absorb odors, and I didn't see any indication that the interior got fresh carpeting and paint. And that a great deal of the DeFeo's furniture was left. The house was basically sold as is. You know, and then again, maybe a squirrel died in the attic. I don't know. Constant swarms of flies, and we're going to talk more about the flies, just you wait. Whispers and voices, specifically that according to George, Father Pecoraro heard a voice say, get out, quote, very strongly. He became ill, had flu-like symptoms, and his hands bled openly for a while. Okay. Daughter Missy had an imaginary friend named Jody, and this one's my favorite, because your instinct might be to think, oh, is Jody somehow a ghost of one of the DeFeo girls? No, Jody was a pig, and there were hoof prints. Yeah.
Ghost pig! Oh my god! Okay.
And there were hoof prints in the snow one time, and bonus, it had glowing red eyes, and apparently could fly because it was seen through a second floor window.
Demon ghost pig. I love it.
I'm telling you, it's my favorite of them all. They leave the house with just the proverbial clothes on their backs. They had lived there for 28 days. You know, right around the time the mortgage payment was coming due. I can't control my snark with this one. I just can't. Because to me, this is so obvious. And if it wasn't just kind of intuitively obvious for everybody, later, George says in an interview with the Washington Post, quote, that they had had money troubles since buying the place in 1975 for $80,000. They had been looking for something in the $30,000 to $50,000 range, but couldn't resist what seemed to be a tremendous bargain. And also, quote, Lutz thought he could just swing it by running his surveying business from the house and by putting his cabin cruiser and speedboat in the boathouse, thus saving marina fees. Or sell the fucking boats?
That's what's gonna save you? That's like the avocado toast. Marina fees?
Right?
That's what's good. Oh, come on, man.
All right. Sell the boats, man. Yeah. If you need the cash. Okay. So they're gone. They're still responsible for paying the mortgage, but apparently they just don't. I'm telling you, my guess is that they didn't budget for rehabbing it and the utility bills on a house that size, not to mention what I imagine are not insubstantial property taxes. So sneaking ahead a little bit, it does go into foreclosure in 1977, and whatever's left in the house, DeFeo property and Lutz possessions, just the furniture, whatnot, it gets auctioned off or donated to charity. Now, I don't know what my next step would be in this situation, other than declaring bankruptcy, I suppose. But in this case, the Lutz's contact Butch's attorney, William Weber, saying they may have something that would be helpful to him and his client, who has been convicted for admittedly killing 6 members of his family, and Weber agrees to meet them. You may ask, why would anybody want to help a family annihilator? Said George, quote, We realized there was something so wrong at the house that it would be inhuman. It would be improper to just let him rot in jail and not try to help him get some kind of psychological help. I mean, okay, that's, I'll tell you what why I think they really did it here in just a minute, but quoting Weber, they verbalized to me that they had had unusual experiences in the house, and they thought that by letting me know about it, that this could possibly be an avenue for a new trial. Because the idea was that if this house was haunted or cursed or whatever, maybe that was what had caused Butch to commit the murders. Again, I kind of don't care about the whys in situations like this, because this person does not need to be in society. He has demonstrated that he clearly cannot be trusted, whether it was due to drugs or he just flew off the handle, or whether he has a serious mental condition. He can't be trusted.
It was the demon pig.
It was Abs snorting all the way home. Back to Weber. Now, he had been planning on getting a book published about the murders and the trial and whatnot, and this piqued his interest as potentially another thread to add to the story. Weber said, quote, Before the Lutzes came into the picture, the book would have been about whether he was criminally insane or a cold-blooded killer. They threw this third aspect into it, which, let's face it, has pizzazz that could make this an attractive item for the general public, and that was possession. Meaning, did some sort of force actually compel or possess Butch? Is that the reason behind the other allegedly strange things associated with the murders? Check out the bonus content. I'm a broken record, I know, but we get into that there.
Wow, they really just did not want to pay for that house.
Right? And so then Weber says to them, quote, I have a commercial venture in this, and why don't we join together? In less words, dollar signs were floating around his head, and it would seem they fluttered over to start floating around the Lutz's heads, too. February 16th, 1976, there's a press conference. Why? How? Can anyone just call a press conference? I don't know. But a press conference is held by the Lutzes and Weber, announcing they were collaborating on a book. And that's when all their purported experiences in the house start getting revealed. And boy howdy, did the press come out of the woodwork. And it was said that the Lutzes were pretty uncomfortable with all the attention. And I just, okay, so here's where I need to spout off a thought real quick. Jumping ahead slightly to what I think is the truth section. Like I said earlier, I think they were strapped for cash and they got in over their heads with this house. And the only thing I can think of with regards to going to Weber is maybe they thought that they could get paid for their information and that this is just the best they could come up with. And I say that to say, how do you not understand that in some regard, such as potentially testifying at a high-profile retrial of a murderer, that this isn't going to garner some attention on some level? I get that they were probably overwhelmed, but come on.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, on the other hand, I do get the impression that it became more than they bargained for, all the interest media-wise, and it ramps up as we go. You will see why. But like I say, I do get the interest. Says reporter Laura DiDio, quote, I mean, all of the elements were there. This house had been the scene of a brutal 6 murders just the year before. Now you have this family that moves out in terror. They've had their life savings sunk into this house, so what's going on there? Now enter local New York news station Channel 5. They get cranking on an investigation into all these claims, doing their due diligence, as it were. They decided to air a special on the house and called in some paranormal experts. Who are you going to call? Why? It's Ed and Lorraine Warren. Those paragons of honesty and forthrightness. Now, Tiff did a great job of covering them in the episode called Happy Little Ectoplasm, so check that out. Not going to go down that road here. Just trust me when I say they love exposure.
Love it.
I mean, big hearts. They get going with a seance, and it's a decent-sized group that's come along, including mediums, psychics, demonologists, and parapsychologists, none of which are actual things. The news station sends anchor Marvin Scott, along with a 3-member crew, to get the goods. Says Marvin, quote, "There were a number of people, and they were going to try to bring forward that energy, that force that they said was in that house. I had never attended a seance, and I was a little excited about it." Yeah, there's nothing like unbiased reporting. No, but seriously, I actually really like Marvin, and you're going to end up liking him too. I promise. So at the time of the documentary, where I'm pulling a lot of these quotes from because there's a ton of interviews in it, Ed had already passed. Don't have an interview with him. But Lorraine was still with us. And here's some of what she said. Quote, "The vibrations were outrageous." You know, Lorraine, bringing toys to work isn't professional. I'm kidding. Allegedly. Okay? Don't sue me. There's no money to be had. Continuing. "What I could perceive in there was so dark and so negative, I didn't really want to look at it. It was so bad. I said, I hope this is as close to hell as I ever get." Stan don't want you, Lorraine. He don't, I promise. A photo I'll stick in show notes appears to indicate that the seance was in maybe the dining room, judging by the table, but apparently they had no luck because they move up to one of the children's bedrooms. Anchorman Marvin says that Lorraine starts crying and going, "I feel it. It's here." "Leave the toys in the car, Lorraine." Allegedly. Then Marvin says, and this is great, "I felt nothing except the pain that she was feeling. I really didn't."
Way to be, Marvin.
Love you, Marv. Back to reporter Laura DiDio, who was also there. I remember at about 3 a.m., Marvin turning to me and saying, "I don't think we have it." Meaning, what you would like to see, The Exorcist on television. Just any physical manifestation of some sort of presence. It just wasn't there. So, another plug. Our very first episode involves the true story behind the movie The Exorcist. Put that on your list if you haven't heard it. We laughed so hard that we hurt. It's called Stan and the Poodle. Okay, says Marvin. God, I love Marvin. "The only voices I heard that night were those of my crew asking when we were going to eat the sandwiches we'd brought along."
Priorities.
Oh, Marvin, I adore you. Now, I'll put it in show notes because why not? But there's this picture that's supposedly from the night of the seance where it looks like a little boy is coming out of a room. And it just, the way he's turned, it looks like someone called his name and he looks at the camera and then snap. Does it look fake? Hell if I know. It's an old ass photo. But what I do know is that it doesn't look like either of the DeFeo sons. It is kind of creepy looking, but mostly because the flash caught in his eyes. But who knows if it was from that night or not. It's just, it's not enough for me. We don't have enough information. I will tell you this, though. Quote, "The photograph did not emerge into the public domain until 1979, when George and Kathy Lutz appeared on the Merv Griffin Show to promote the release of the first film."
Come on.
And besides, here's my issue. Is this about some demon thing that had always been in the house? Or are we now saying it's the DeFeos? Are we saying it's something else? Just pick a lane. And where's that goddamn demon pig?
Yeah.
Oh, and there is a something else, by the way, another option that's proposed. Hang tight. It's a doozy. May 1976. The Lutzes move across the country to L.A. Writer Jay Anson has contacted them, and they decide to do a book with him instead of the lawyer Weber. End quote. The Lutzes said they felt pressured by Weber and did not like his idea of offering a share of the profits to DeFeo. George later saying in a British documentary that it would be like, quote, effectively paying him for the murder. So Weber's out and Anson is in. Weber was still going to write about it, and despite their lack of direct involvement any longer, he was still going to pursue the whole next family there was haunted, possession made Butch do it angle. He decides to have his own paranormal-themed investigation, and he says, quote, wanted to get some people who had recognition in the media, at least, to participate in it. Because, spoiler, Weber doesn't believe a lick of this otherworldly stuff. He says so in the interview. And he's no fool when it comes to getting exposure and getting himself more business in general. He'd also said to reporters during the trial that, quote, he was charging DeFeo only a modest fee, and that, I'm getting more out of this from the publicity. He is refreshingly blunt. Okay, so who are you going to call this time? Not the Warrens, of course. That's old news. You call in Hans Holzer, a parapsychologist, and he brings in Ethel Johnson Myers, a, quote, deep trance medium. And they say, no, this isn't a demonic presence, nor is it the DeFeos. This is the spirit of a Native American man who was buried under the property.
I know.
That old yarn.
It's like they're just, you know, oh, it can't be this. What's next on the list? Could it be that? Yep. Let's just, ugh.
Yeah, that whole yarn about it's built on Native American burial grounds. Nyeh. There's racism undertones in there. It's, nyeh. Naturally, I looked up these folks. Not a lot out there on old Ethel, but briefly, about Hans. Some in the woo-woo community seem to have a poor opinion of him, as, quote, Holzer's endorsement of psychics and ghost hunting was criticized in an article for the Journal of the Society for Psychical Research, which cast considerable doubt on the objectivity and reliability of his work as a whole. Ruh-roh. Also, talking about the psychics he used, the stuff they would say was, quote, information that could be gleaned from research sources or from knowledgeable persons by cold reading. And cold reading, if you don't know, or just to remind you, is when someone who's pretty intuitive, such as purported mediums or psychics or mentalists or fortune tellers, whatever, is making informed guesses about their mark based on things like ethnicity, age, gender, religion, where they live, stuff like that, and also kind of baiting them in with generic stuff like, somebody close to you died, a woman, and some found her death to be sudden. Well, everybody's had a woman who they were close to die, and some people probably did find it sudden. Then if they're wrong, they'll spin it and move on quickly. You get the idea. Read up on that on your own time. It's really fascinating. And on an aside, there were other people in the woo realm who doubted, one specifically being another parapsychologist who was brought in by Weber called Stephen Kaplan, who was convinced it was a hoax and later wrote a book about it because he, quote, became concerned that the Lutz's story, which he considered bogus, would give paranormal research a bad name. Oh, Stephen, allow me to introduce you to ghost hunting reality TV. I mean, oh, you're going to spin in circles when you see that if you think this is what was giving it a bad name. All right, then, what is the deal with this unfortunate Native American fellow? Ethel is saying that the house is built over, you guessed it, a burial ground, and that the disturbances are due to, quote, the angry spirit of a Shinnecock Indian chief, Rolling Thunder, who had possessed the previous occupant, Ronald DeFeo Jr., driving him to murder his family. One source said that there's photos. I did not look them up. My bullshit tolerance meter was already way too high. And the photos supposedly showed ghostly halos around bullet marks. In the walls? Don't know. But there wasn't any in the walls by my research because all the bullets unfortunately hit their targets. But anyway, not the point. The point is that, quote, the claim that the house was built on Indian sacred land was, however, denied by the local Amityville Historical Society, and it was pointed out that it was the Montaukett Indians and not the Shinnecocks who had been the original settlers in the area. Hans, Ethel, it's called a library. Grifts do need some element of truth to them, however scant.
Yikes. That's like basic.
That is basic stuff. This is Junior League right here. Okay. There's a little bit of the audio Hans recorded that night of Ethel, which is in the documentary. And of course, I've got linked in show notes. And it's about 25 minutes in if you're interested in hearing it. But I have to throw in this one thing. I can't tell if this quote was from the chief of the Montaukett's at the time, or if he was the chief at the time of the source I'm pulling this quote from, which was a 2002 ABC News report. But a Chief Straight Arrow Cooper said, even if there was a Montaukett burial ground under there, and even if there was an uneasy spirit, quote, that doesn't mean we will go into somebody's body and capture their soul and control it in a negative way. That's not us. I love him.
Not our jam.
That's not us. I love that.
That's off brand. Sorry.
That was just great. You picked up on exactly what I loved about that sentence. That's not us. Because that's exactly how it's written. Control in a very negative way. Big dash. That's not us. Moving on. Back to the Jay Anson book. In September 1977, the Amityville Horror, A True Story, is published, and it's a huge hit. 2 years later comes a movie starring James Brolin and Margot Kidder. By the way, there's not, I don't think, been a day in that man's life where he hadn't been beautiful. I mean, God almighty. And it's great for the time, though I prefer the Ryan Reynolds version from, I think, the early 2000s, because he is legit scary in it. If you have a picture of Ryan Reynolds in your mind of, you know, just this
goofy frat boy. Yeah.
Happy-go-lucky. Yeah, goofy, good looking, but goofy, just quick-witted and all this stuff. I really want you to go watch the early 2000s. I want to say like 2005, Amityville Horror, and prepare to be quite impressed. He is frightening in it. It's very, very, he is very, very good. The movie, I could take or leave, but he's quite good in it. Okay, anyway, talking about Anson, quote, as William Peter Blatty did when he promoted The Exorcist, Anson vouched for the truthfulness of his fantastic tale, saying, there is simply too much independent corroboration of their narrative to support the speculation that the Lutzes either imagined or fabricated these events. And further on the topic of the movie, we gotta go back to our beloved Marvin again. Quote, often I'm asked if I was scared that night that I spent in the house. No. To be quite honest, it was much more fearful the night I spent watching the film with a pot-smoking, rowdy, disruptive audience. Marvin, you are an absolute gem. The Lutzes get famous doing the press circuit after the movie, and now it's a whole new ballgame. This ain't a local jam anymore. This is nationwide. It's a huge media thing across the country, meaning more eyes are on them and on this story. Now, about a year had passed before the house was occupied again in the spring of 77 with a family by the name of Cromarty, headed by Jim and Barbara. They had gotten it for a steal. Remember, this should be a high five-figure or probably a six-figure piece of property and home. The Lutzes had paid $80,000 and the Cromartys only paid $55,000.
Ooh.
Uh-huh. They soon found themselves with a mission, getting the truth out. Surprise, the truth is that there's not a haunting. Okay. In case anybody hadn't picked up on that. Because they were done pretty quick with their house being the subject of all of this mess. It started becoming kind of a tourist attraction. People were constantly asking them what they were experiencing. You get the picture. It is a daily annoyance. Quote, instead of spirits, the Cromartys complained, they were haunted by what could only be called paranormal. Why am I saying that so stupid? Instead of spirits, the Cromartys complained, they were haunted by what could only be called paranormal tourists, who knocked on the door at all hours of the day and night. These people sometimes called themselves witches. Sometimes they cursed out the Cromartys and told them they would die. Sometimes they were drunk. And sometimes, as the family told Newsday in 1978, they were just odd. I think one of the funniest things was when we woke up at 3 o'clock and heard this guy with a bugle playing taps on the front lawn. I opened the window and applauded and said, kid, you got a real good sense of humor, said Jim. And everybody knows what taps is, right?
I hope that kid won a bet. It was worth a lot of money because that's amazing.
Barbara was less amused and much more straightforward. In a TV interview, she says, this house is not haunted. It never was haunted. This is nothing but a money-making fraud. Hello, Barbara. Please take a seat beside Marvin. You two are the king and queen of this story. And guess who else is now publicly saying this is a bunch of crap? Weber. He says that most of the Lutz story details were invented by him. And he was also debunking what they were telling him as they were telling him, like to their faces. So I can kind of get why, when presented with the opportunity, they'd go with someone else. So this, let's just knock these out. The slime. He said that's fingerprint powder catching the light. Y'all were the first people there after the crime. Not all that stuff was cleaned up. Well, what about seeing the demonic pig's shiny eyes outside the window? Via his interviewing neighbors for the trial, it somehow came up through chatting that regarding one particular neighbor, their cat was notorious for finding its way up trees and hopping on roofs. More than once, it had scared the shit out of them when they'd see it outside windows. And, you know, lots of animals have eye shine in the darkness. The pig
so
wasn't.
It was not a demonic pig, damn it.
Unfortunately. Then what about the constant flies? Well, it's in the police report that flies were already swarming at the time of the murders because, and let's just tear through this real quick. And y'all should know this from crime shows, but flies are attracted to dead things, and blowflies will lay eggs within minutes of somebody dying. Then within roughly 24 hours, the eggs have already hatched, and then comes the maggots and blah, 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 blah. You know all the rest, I would think. But the point is, those flies the cops saw were cruising the bodies and laying eggs. When the bodies were taken away, there's still flies in the house. Now they cruise to whatever nooks and crannies are in this nice, warm, heated in the winter house to lay eggs, and flies really like moist places, and I assure you, in the rooms with the bodies, things were getting moist. Decomp is nothing if not messy. And also, the body tends to let loose of what it's holding when all the sphincters are no longer functioning, so there.
Moist.
There you go. I say all that to say, the flies who didn't get a chance at the bodies laid eggs in the windowsills or other cracks and cozy places, and when there's that many to start with, they're just going to continuously reproduce. You have to call an exterminator at that point. What about that red room hidden in the basement? Patrick O'Reilly, the DeFeo's next-door neighbor at the time, he was very close friends with the kids and was over at their house just practically always, you know, after school, immediately doing slumber parties, the whole nine yards. Well, it turns out that this room was not hidden. I think one of the movies presents it as under the stairs or that you had to break down drywall to get to it. Not true.
Yeah, I think there was some like brick wall or something that they, I vaguely remember that from a movie.
There you go. Like, again, like hidden. Like you wouldn't have seen it on a house tour, but no, not true. Patrick says that one day he and one of the sons were playing in the basement and quote, Mr. DeFeo came down with a gallon of paint and brought three brushes and rollers and says, here you go, boys. This is going to be your toy closet area. Help me paint it. And we did. Why was it red? Because that's the paint he had on hand. If it was blue paint, then the room would have been the blue room. It was a toy closet. That's all it was. What about the priest who experienced the voice and all the physical symptoms? His diocese denies that these things happened. I'm going to read you what they said in a second. Though I will note here that Laura DiDio states she interviewed the priest and that he confirmed the story. Now, I'm not asserting that she's lying. I need more information, such as his age at the time she interviewed him, perhaps any sort of dementia or dementia-related issues he may have been facing at the time, had he seen the movie and or read the book. I would need to know more about any potentially relevant circumstances. Other than the diocese denial, a researcher called Rick Moran dug into the Lutz claims and ended up with a list of more than 100 factual errors and discrepancies between what was asserted in the book and things that could actually be verified with other parties. Kind of like how that historical society was able to rebut the Native American claims, things like that. Moran says he also interviewed Father Pecoraro and that, quote, he never said that he saw anything in the house. Some places you'll see it claimed that Pecoraro never even went to the house, that he just consulted Kathy by phone. But here's what the 2002 letter from the diocese said, and it was a response to an investigator's inquiry. They confirmed Pecoraro worked there and confirmed that he did advise the Lutzes, and that, quote, because of his concern over the publicity attached to the story, he petitioned and was granted a leave of absence for personal reasons on May 1, 1978. He went to the Diocese of Oakland and worked there. However, he eventually left and dropped out of sight. He surfaced on occasion but made no attempt to return and serve within this diocese, even though we encouraged him to do so. Eventually, his whereabouts became unknown to us until hearing of his death in 1987. They then go on to deny that any of the reported woo-woos were true and say that their attorneys had actually written a letter to the book publishers in 1977 containing, quote, a substantial list of numerous inaccuracies, factually incorrect references, and untrue statements regarding events, persons, and occurrences that never happened. Some will come back with, well, do we trust the Catholic Church? That is up to you to decide. But according to my sources, Pecoraro did speak for himself in interviews and also on the legal record in a trial I'm going to tell you about later. Quote, Father Pecoraro's relationship to the case was described in an affidavit. It read, Father Ralph J. Pecoraro has indicated that his only contact relating to this case was a telephone call from the Lutzes regarding their psychic experiences. Aha! And further, quote, during the trial, Father Pecoraro testified over the phone and denied any of the so-called supernatural afflictions that Anson claimed the priest had suffered in his book. He also told the judge that he was not sure if there were any supernatural occurrences at the house. Aha, again. Further, When interviewed by Newsday, Pecoraro, quote, told the newspaper that he had known Kathy during her first marriage and had instructed George, a Methodist, since converted to Catholicism, before their marriage. But he had never been near the house and had referred the couple to a local parish priest to whom they never went. He also denied a story that his own quarters at Rockville Center were overwhelmed by a smell of excrement, supposedly a satanic sign, and added that his colleagues there made a joke of the claim. Again, the more you get into this, the more random things. Oh, and by the way, did we mention that the priest's bedroom smelled like shit? Like, no, that wasn't. Like, you just see all this. It's infuriating. Okay. And then, per the Washington Post, George said that there were even more clergy than had been reported. Quote, there were a number of priests involved who will never be told about. Also, a rabbi. It'll never be told unless I find a publisher for a follow-up book. And one of those priests, who apparently was named at some point, a Father Camarado, quote, who the Lutzes say was shown the wrecked garage door, the footprints of a gigantic pig in the snow, and a terrible face burned into the fireplace wall. Well, he says that he had never been to the house. So to sum up, the priest element in all of this is a flaming hot mess. We're not going to go through the rest of the Lutz's assertions because they're stupid and are either easily explained or can be presumed to be blatant lies. And strange things to lie about, too, such as that whole doors coming off thing. People can see that that's not true. Quote, no doors or windows in the house were found to have ever been ripped off their hinges. All were found undamaged and securely mounted with all of their original hardware. And they also found no weirdness with the paint or the varnish. So is the demon a skilled contractor, perhaps?
He just saw that they were having a hard time affording the remodeling. I just wanted to step in.
Maybe Stan, it was Stan. Yeah.
Stan works in mysterious ways.
Stan, we have found to be a very cool dude. You know, friend of the podcast, Satan. Stan, as we call him. Okay. Then there were some incidents that involved things like a full moon on Christmas Eve, which can be proven untrue by the weather almanac, and a wild snowstorm, which, again, you can confirm the weather on certain dates and times. We had and have the records. And like, okay, the waking up and feeling like you're pinned to the bed is a nightmare still lingering, or night terrors, or more likely, sleep paralysis. Hey, and sidebar, you want to know a trick if you suffer from that type of stuff? I don't know if you do. Do you?
I don't.
Okay, well, anybody listening, if you suffer from this kind of stuff, here's a trick. Most people, and by most, I mean an incredibly high percentage, like you may as well say nobody, but we'll just say most people cannot read in their dreams. And I'll try to find a good article on it to stick in show notes for you. But anyway, I had known this. And then last year, I'm watching this great show called Evil, and I truly hope it comes back. Last I heard that it is, but I highly recommend it. And they had a great scene in it where one of the characters is having recurrent night terrors, and in them she's paralyzed and a demon comes into her bedroom and is messing with her. So one night before she goes to sleep, she gets a big piece of paper, and I'm going blank on what she wrote. I think it was something to the effect of, can you read this? She tapes it on the ceiling above the bed. So cue the nightmare. And when the demon is hovering over her, she's of course looking up at him, and she catches the sign out of the corner of her eye over his shoulder, and it's a bunch of gibberish. So it jolts her into realizing that this isn't real, that she's in a dream. And so all she has to do is tell herself to wake up. So she essentially induces a lucid dream state. And if I can find the clip, I'll stick it in show notes too. But all right, back to the story. Here's a kicker. On one occasion when the Lutzes met with Weber, they recorded the conversation. The originals are long gone, but apparently the Lutzes had them in their possession at some point because they let reporter Laura DiDio listen to them. And they had told her, quote, we're not very proud of this. And the content was basically them talking about how they could expound upon the events, make them more sensational. Because remember from our first episode, talking about The Exorcist, this was a national sensation. And this wasn't too many years after the events of Amityville, that is. That was 73, and we're in 79. And The Exorcist 2 had just come out in 1977, and it was garbage, but it was popular. Anyhow, Weber says that throughout this night, the one that was taped, that between the three of them, they downed like four bottles of wine, just sitting there and tweaking all this shit. Quote, there was a lot of giddiness, a lot of laughing, a lot of jokes, and this is despite their alleged experiences at the house. The Lutzes, though, they insisted their experiences were true. That sure, the book and the movie had exaggerated stuff for effect, but quote, also believed that they were the victims of a media frenzy that blurred the line between their fact and fiction. On that note, They took lie detector tests to try to prove themselves. Reportedly, a former CIA official administered the tests, which I guess is supposed to lend credibility, and they both passed. So here's the deal. Lie detector tests are not science. They're not even close. You can be stating absolute fact and blow a lie detector test because you're a nervous wreck and your heart rate's all over the place. And the key is this. These tests are not determining the truth. They're measuring if the subject believes it's the truth. Can actual truth and your truth overlap? Sometimes, not all the time. And when you can't replicate something over and over and over again in a controlled environment with consistency, that ain't science. They aren't even a good tool. It blows my mind that professional organizations of any sort still think that they are. So, let's go from the perspective that the Lutzes truly believed they had paranormal experiences. I already told you that Kathy was a practicing Catholic, and quote, "It's in the Catholic tradition that you see a focus on demonic possession. Some polls show that Catholics may be among the groups that are higher in believing in ghosts, for example, because they have a rich tradition of apparitional experiences." Who am I quoting there? Why, it's one of my favorite people on the planet. He has come up on the show before, and that is the legitimate paranormal investigator, Joe Nickel. I've covered this before when Nickel has come up, but to refresh your memory, the way he approaches this kind of thing is not from a mindset of going in with the attitude of there's nothing there, this is all in somebody's head. What he does is have a very Occam's razor approach. He starts with a list of all the natural phenomena things it could be, and drilling down, discarding, until, hypothetically, nothing is left but the supernatural. It's a Sherlock Holmes thing of if you do enough eliminating, the one which remains must be the truth. But it, hasn't happened yet. Check out the episode called Pigeon Jockeys to hear more about Joe's methodology. I just started calling by his first name like we're buds. Anyway.
Mention him enough on the show and maybe he will be.
Joe Nickel, please come on the show. I would shut up and I'd let you talk. That's not true. I can't shut up and let anybody talk, but I would try.
Hey y'all, this is Cindy from Dummy World. Together with my co-host Kelly, we examine the underbelly of society. From true crime to urban legends to cults and beyond, Dummy World supplies your weekly fix of the dark side of life. New episodes air Monday. Find Dummy World where your favorite podcasts live.
So Nickel goes on to say, quote, "It becomes a snowball effect. No longer is a noise simply some creaking of an old house, it's the footsteps of a ghost." And in this vein, Professor Richard Wiseman from the University of Hertfordshire in England, who specializes in the psychology of hauntings, says, quote, "If you have an experience, and it's quite a scary one, you become hypervigilant. So once you kick this thing off, it can become very contagious, not only for yourself, but for those who are with you." Which, I immediately think of these poor children. Again, George has said that they discussed it as a family, and I can't fathom being a 5 or 7 or 9-year-old being told I'm about to live in a house where 6 people just died, murder or not. I mean, they're not old enough to process that. And specifically talking about Missy and her imaginary friend turned demon pig, quote, "2/3 of children under the age of 7 at some time develop imaginary friends, but in Amityville House, it was interpreted as a sign of the demonic." And says Nickel, quote, "One can only imagine the terror for children in a situation in which they're led to believe that there are sinister boogeymen at work in a house. Children have nightmares, and the adults are supposed to go comfort them. What happens if the adults need comforting? You have the worst of all possible situations." And I'm going to add on to that. Home is where you're supposed to feel safe. It's one of the reasons why domestic violence is so insidious, because it's one thing if you're mugged on the street. You could potentially avoid that street to mitigate some of the trauma, but then you go home, you lock your doors and your windows, and you feel safe. But when your safe space is out of play, and that's even worse for children. And more on the kids when we do the where are they now at the end. So thanks to the film, this is now a worldwide thing, and this small town is just inundated. And quote, "On some days, the population nearly doubled to 20,000 people. There would be bus tours going by the house. There were some accounts of tourists bringing small hatchets to try and cut off a piece of the house." As we know, the Cromarties were thrilled. And it wasn't just them. Nearby houses were, of course, feeling the weight of this mess, too. And there were reports of tourists literally setting up campsites on lawns. People are so utterly and irredeemably stupid. Anyway, the Lutzes don't have to deal with that shit. They're long gone. End quote. Since literally running away from the house in January of 1976, leaving behind all their possessions, the Lutzes have not had jobs, though they are renting a $100,000 house near San Diego. They say their 50% share of the book money, they missed out on the film rights, goes mostly to pay lawyers and old debts. Lawyers, you ask? Whatever could this be about? Real quick, though, I am confused about the actual amounts that the Lutzes got, because it does not sound like, at least in some places, that they got shares of sales. It sounds like they just got one lump sum of money for the rights to the story, like once from the studios, once from the publishers. They say that they only got $300,000. Another place says no, that it was $100,000 for the book, $100,000 for the film. So you got me. Like I said, though, we know one place the money was going, to lawyers, because, quote, the copyright to their story became the subject of several bitter court cases, and, quote, once enough money had been made by the book, the lawsuits began. Lutz and Weber sued each other and just about everyone else under the sun, with claims such as breach of contract, misappropriation of names, and mental distress. Yeah, remember how they ditched Weber for Anson? Well, apparently there was indeed a contract, which I assumed because, hello, he's a lawyer, and Weber filed a $2 million lawsuit for reneging on the book deal. The Lutzes countersued Weber for $1 million because of him stating in an Associated Press article all the stuff about them essentially conspiring together on the story. There was a policeman who was named in Anson's book, so he sued the Lutzes and the publisher. The Lutzes sued over a 1977 Good Housekeeping article, as well as suing the New York Daily News and the authors of the articles, saying they were invasions of privacy. And while the judge threw out the publication's end of it, quote, the remaining defendants were eventually settled for undisclosed terms in 1979. The Cromarties sued the Lutzes, Anson, and the publisher for fraud to the tune of $1.1 million because of the subtitle of the book, A True Story, which I assume they tied to the constant harassment of Looky Loos. This was settled for an undisclosed six-figure amount in 1982, and good for them.
Hell yeah!
Go Cromarties! And then George Lutz sued stepson Christopher in 2003, quote, over what Christopher said are allegations of trademark infringement and fraud relating to a future Amityville movie planned by Lutz. I do not understand what that means, unless Christopher had a project going that I missed. I just don't know what came of that. I'm so very, very tired, and I'm tapped out in terms of my digging. But what's up with the stepson coming back into play? Well, let's start our Where Are They Now portion, or Where Were They Then? Because I've seen nothing from recent years coming up about them. So, the Lutz kids. I could find nothing on Missy, but the brothers, we've got some dish. In 2013, there was a documentary called My Amityville Horror, in which the oldest son, Danny, participated. He asserts that this was all George's doing, not the DeFeos haunting them, or a spontaneous demonic presence, or a Native American spirit, that George played around with the occult. He also clearly hated George. Quote, a vain, domineering stepfather, he had terrorized his stepchildren. He sometimes beat them with a wooden spoon as punishment. And in another source, it says that in the documentary, Danny said that George himself was, quote, possessed. He says the rampant flies part was true. He said a window suddenly fell shut on his hand, and that there was another story about a toilet filling with black ooze. But then in one of the books, it said that Kathy suspected Danny had done it, that he'd put black paint in the toilet, whether to scare her or just a kid thinking this is how you get rid of the rest of the paint you were using.
Just why the fuck not? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily think that it was something malicious. I could see somebody saying to a kid, hey, there's some paint left in the bottom of this can, go get rid of it. And the kid thinking, all right, I'll just pour it down the sink or dump it in the toilet. I mean, I genuinely can't. Anyway, like I say, Danny hated George, it is made clear, saying his stepfather was, quote, the biggest fucking asshole you could ever meet.
Oh, yeah, he hated him.
Mm-hmm. And boasted that he was glad he was dead. An ex-Marine, George was, according to Danny, a violent disciplinarian who beat him. And so, he admits, I started destroying this guy's world every opportunity that I walked into, and would just do anything to get him. And I'm not sure precisely what that means, other than that, this is, again, many years after George died, so maybe he means ruining his reputation or something. That's the impression I get from that quote. In any event, at the end of the documentary, here we go again, he's asked to take a lie detector test, which he refuses. And y'all know my thoughts on that. I don't think anybody should take them. They're trash. But even though the siblings didn't participate in the documentary, and I found nothing that Missy has ever spoken publicly about it, the younger brother Christopher had prior in a 2005 interview with the Seattle Times. Quoting him, "So far there's been three representations of what happened in that house, and not one of them, not the book, not the movie, not the remake, is accurate." And he's in step with his brother. He also says that yes, paranormal shit happened, but that he believes it was brought on by George messing with the occult. That he was, quote, "extremely curious of everything paranormal and tried to summon supernatural beings by chanting." And that yes, George juiced up the incidents to, quote, "profit off books and movies about the house. He's a professional showman, in my opinion. I just feel as though we're being exploited." Christopher says that the doors being ripped off the hinges didn't happen, which, I mean, we already knew that, but that he did see a shadow in the shape of a man coming at him, and other times it threw the kids around and up the stairs and whatnot. Again, the claims are myriad. Everything you look at, you're going to find the same stuff repeated, yes, but it's like there's always new little tidbits tacked on. I never saw a fully comprehensive list. Literally, every source I looked at, there was another little thing thrown in there, just rando. And
It was the same thing with the Winchester house. It was like, really? Now you have to say that? Okay.
What of the Lutzes themselves? They ultimately divorced in 1988. Kathy died in 2004 and George died in 2006. Awfully young, the both of them. They always maintained that they didn't make anything up. Quote, "George denies making anything up." That was an accident. That was an accident. I don't believe in it.
I'm so glad that we have that to back it up.
I can't breathe. Quote, "George and I is making anything up," saying that if they had, they would have come up with a better story and would not have fled their house, leaving their belongings behind. And also, quote, "We would have been much surer of when and how things happened because we would have been inventing them," which is a weird defense to me, but okay.
Okay.
What of Ronald DeFeo Jr., a.k.a. Sorry.
Are you still stuck on the heat tonight?
Yes. God almighty. What of Ronald DeFeo Jr., a.k.a. Butch the Bitch? Well, we're going to cover what's been up with him from the trial to present day in the bonus content, but briefly, in terms of the haunting story and him possibly being possessed, Butch later wrote in a letter, quote, "Amityville was a hoax that Weber and the Lutzes started to make money. It started as my trial was in progress. And years later, after it was obvious the book and the movie were huge successes, when asked what he thought about all that, he said, quote, the only thing that's real were the murders. Yes, it's all a hoax. It's all about money. A cold-blooded murder, period. No ghosts, no demons. This ain't funny no more. People look in my eyes like I'm possessed or something. I'm sick of it." Oh, well, Butch, well, bless your heart.
I am just a straight-up murderer, okay? Appreciate me for what I am.
And, Butch, are people looking at you funny? Well, bless your heart. Bless it. Piece of shit. People, you're a piece of shit, and that's what people look like. Look, you know what I mean. There's so much Bailey's in my coffee, okay? And finally, what of the house? In total, the house has been sold 5 times over the past 33 years. The Cromarties had the address changed to 108 Ocean Avenue from 112, hoping to, quote, stave off stalkers and retain its fluctuating value. They lived there for about 10 years, selling it in 87. Those owners also lived there about 10 years. They sell it in 97 for $310,000. These occupants stayed longer till 2017 when it sold for $605,000, which was $200,000 less than the asking price of $850,000. And then I don't know what for real magic happened, but I saw that in 2010 it was on sale for $1.15 million. Did they install a helicopter pad? I just don't know why the price bumped, but it sold for $950,000. If it's me, okay, if I had the money, I'd buy it and I'd demolish it. I'd level that sumbitch and I'd start fresh. Anyway, upon a Google, best I can tell is that it's still occupied as of October 2020. That was the latest update on Realtor.com. So when all's been said and done, there have been at least a dozen films and, as far as the book, over 10 million copies sold. And then on top of that, we're not even counting all the discrediting type books out there. And so this is a multi-million dollar empire surrounding this lovely house that I would raise down past the first five layers of dirt at least. I would go to bedrock and just start over. I'm going to end with this quite profound, in my opinion, quote. I really think this is going to get you because this is from an article several years ago. It's very prescient. Quote, in the 1970s, American culture was awash in superstition. It was a time rather like our own, filled with economic and political instability. The Lutz family's press conference took place 18 months after Watergate had forced Richard Nixon to resign the presidency, and the onslaught of upsetting news had led everyone to question conventional facts and truth. Anger and fear were everywhere, and often enough, they bloomed into outright delusions. Couple that with the remnants of the New Age philosophies of the 1960s, shake in a little bit of good old American folklore, and you got something like what the Lutz family story would eventually be, the Amityville Horror.
Ooh.
Okay, so now let's backtrack to talk about the murders. And if you're checking out now, thank you for listening. Hope you enjoyed. Starting back at the night in question, again, it is the evening of November 13th, and quote, Butch left work and went to a bar. He kept calling his home to no avail. I don't get that phrasing. They're saying that he didn't get an answer. Why not just say that? Whatever. And complained to patrons about it. Then a little while later, Butch has come running back into this bar, saying that when he got home, he discovered his parents had been murdered. Specifically, quote, at 6:30 p.m., he swung open the door of the bar and shouted, please, you've got to help me. I think my mother and father are shot. Then it said he fell to his knees weeping. And you might be thinking, sure, going to a local bar is exactly what you do. You don't run over to a neighbor's house in panic. You don't hysterically call the police. You head to the bar. But I do want to pause and say something about that, even though we do know already that he's the killer. For me personally, I don't like it when law enforcement or anybody else judges how people react when they're confronted with something horrible, because when in shock, there's no one way that people act across the board. And it could be that his brain just went on autopilot. That's the last place he was at where he felt comfort. He knew that friends were there. So fine. Having said that, is this unusual? Oh, yes. Again, we know that he's the killer. And so I think that there's another more reasonable theory for why he went to the bar, both before and after, and we'll get there. All right, so Butch and a group of people go to the house. The bar is reportedly a hop skip away. And the door is unlocked, and the dog is barking its head off. It's been tied up to the kitchen door. They also see the parents' bodies. The cops are called. Then it's the cops who find the rest of the bodies. By the way, there's plenty of crime scene photos, but they will not be in show notes. Y'all just knock yourselves out if you want to search for them. They take Butch to the police station for his protection because everybody's like, holy shit, you'd have been killed if you were here. Thank goodness you were at work. And that was proven that he was at work. He was a mechanic. Meantime, they determined that all had been shot with a .35 caliber rifle, each of the kids once and the parents twice each, the parents in their backs, the boys in their backs, and the girls in their heads, all at mid and close range. Nobody's sniping through a window from across the yard is my point. I infer that they based on liver temperature that the murders happened around 3 a.m., and I want to remind you that this is in the Northeast in November. No way that they've not got the heat cranked. So to me, And in one of my sources, seems like the ME agrees because he's not precisely stating that this is the exact time of death. He just says, quote, early morning hours. He approximates 3. I'm bring that up for a reason. Hang tight. Every single one of them were in the same position. Quote, all 6 family members were found lying in their respective beds in separate rooms with their faces down and their hands raised above their heads. And I don't know about you guys, but all I'd ever heard was that they were found, like, sleeping in their beds.
Right.
That's right.
Weird that they all sleep like that.
You are taking the words out of my mouth. Exactly. And they hadn't been put there, as in they weren't killed elsewhere, then placed and posed. They were killed in the beds. There wasn't like blood puddles in the hallway, is what I'm saying. The next day, they're interviewing Butch now that he's calmer because he was a total mess at the scene, quote, sobbing uncontrollably. Again, understandable, even if that bar thing may not be. So they're not exactly questioning him, just feeling him out. And also asking a very important question, which is, do you have any idea who could have done this? And Butch says he thinks it might have been done by a mob hitman named Louis Fellini. What? Well, this is less of a stretch than may seem at first blush, because Ronald's, the dad's, his uncle was Pete DeFeo, a.k.a. Philly Aquilino.
What?
Formerly in the Luciano crime family, now a capo, or captain, in the Genovese crime family. I mean, he's got his own Wikipedia page and everything. This was legit.
Hot damn.
You know you've made it then. Butch says about the hitman that, quote, Fellini had lived with the DeFeo family briefly and knew of a certain area in the basement Butch and his father had stored a collection of cash and gems. What? Why? Because? And gems? Like jewelry?
Is duck like gemstones?
Like, is jewelry maybe the word that they were looking for, that this writer was searching for? Okay. Skipping ahead, just to get this out of the way, they determined that Fellini was out of town, he had a solid alibi, and that our old buddy Philly Aquilino over here had nothing to do with it either. So just go on and disregard that. They did check, but, and again, the other reason to disregard it is we know that Butch is the killer. Okay. But even before they checked, it mostly got disregarded immediately because all of a sudden, Butch just admits he did it. Seriously, he had been elaborating on this hitman story, then a detective says, quote, did it really happen that way? And he goes, no.
Oh my God.
He then continues, it all started so fast. Once I started, I just couldn't stop. Afterwards, he took a bath and got ready for work. And on the way, he throws the gun in the creek behind the house, gets rid of the bloody clothes in a storm drain, and goes on to have a normal day. According to reporting by the New York Times, this turned into a 20-hour-long interview, which I find inappropriate, but it's the 70s. Initially, he's giving no reasoning for why he did it, though he does ask them how to collect the $200,000 insurance policy on his parents. He tells them that he killed the parents first, then the brothers, then the sisters. He tells them the locations of where he tossed the evidence. He tells them that he drugged his family by putting a barbiturate drug into their dinners, something the ME initially found believable because there were no puncture wounds. And he commented that he found it hard to believe the kids wouldn't have heard the gunshots killing the parents and gotten up. So the drugging made sense to him, but we're going to talk about this in more detail because it's part of a semi-controversy. Now, I read or heard somewhere, and forgive me, I'm just going blank, that the toxicology tests weren't run until like 2 weeks out. Your girl Nash found this highly unusual, so I went digging. Evidence paperwork, and by that I mean the records that were submitted to that department by those on the scene who collected it, shows blood samples, along with hair samples and the bullet fragments and fingernail scrapings and whatnot. They were logged as evidence on the 14th and 15th. I mean, with the officers' names and times, very thorough. So, a couple days is what we're talking about. Essentially, on the day the bodies were found, they were on the scene past midnight, and then the day after. Perfectly reasonable. Then the date of the typed-up version, done by the tech and signed off by them and the lab director, that date is the 27th. So my best guess is that's where this was coming from. People are looking at the date of the typed-up official version of the handwritten evidence vouchers. So
yeah, that's not right.
So it's like, pay attention, people who are trying to make this.
I can vouch for that. I work in an industry and we have to deal with police reports all the time. And it takes them like 7 to 10 business days. So when there's a date on it, that's not the date that it was actually initially written.
Same thing in healthcare. You handwrite stuff. Sometimes it depends on where you work. But a lot of times you're handwriting out the lab orders and everything. But then later, if you were to see your medical record, whether it's electronic or going and getting a copy in person, it's all going to be nice and typed up. Because that's why there are transcriptionists. Hello. That's what their job is, to transcribe. And, you know, you occasionally might get a phone call that says, hey, I'm trying to decipher this word. Can you help me out? Or whatever. So anyway, if I'm being a little bitchy here, but if the people who are spreading this information at him, sometimes other podcasts, you need to pay attention to, you know, you need to see if A, you can find the original of something, and B, actually look at it. So, okay, I'm done. Second thing, about it being stated that barbiturates were what he used, also unclear where this is coming from, other than Butch, which we know he's such a reliable source, and I'll tell you why. From the evidence log, the following was removed from the house. 3 packages of Cerex capsules, which is like Lixazepam, that's a benzo, used for anxiety, definitely drowsy side effects. 8 boxes Atarax tablets, that's hydroxyzine, it's an antihistamine and has drowsy side effects. 1 box Cinequan capsules, that's doxepin, it's a tricyclic antidepressant that can have drowsy side effects. Not in everybody, that's one of those that it just depends. Certain antidepressants do, that's not uncommon, but it doesn't affect everybody. Okay, none of these are barbiturates. Not a friggin' clue what that was about, unless there were pills that were missed, which I doubt, seems like they were very thorough, or let's say there were barbiturates and Butch used them all, which I will allow as a possibility, but I tell you, I actually happen to think that he didn't drug them. Which leads us into another air quotes controversy. Some people were and are still fixated upon, how did the kids not hear the gunshots? It's in the reports that neighbors did hear the DeFeo's dog, just again, barking its head off, but that this wasn't unusual. And it's not like these are condos or something. These are all big houses that were built back in the day, and they were all spread out. I know that nowadays, if you look at, you know, go to Google Maps, do some overheads, and you're going to see the difference between houses and neighborhoods, rather, that were built, let's say, 80s and prior. Let's just say that. Because the house I grew up in was built in the 70s, and we had plenty of yard space. There was plenty of room between us and other houses. But if you look at getting into the 90s and 2000s, more modern day neighborhoods, they pack houses pretty tightly as possible. Mm-hmm. So these were spread out, is my point. Okay, so there's that. But talking about the kids, for me, this isn't some mystery because, well, okay, so hang on. Let's put the drugging aside for a second, because if he gave it to them at dinner, let's assume anywhere from 6 to 8, a lot of that's going to be worn off by, again, we'll just go with it, 3 a.m., unless he gave horse doses. Because if he stuck it in soup or something, you can't determine how much each person got. So that's my point. Let's just set the drugging part aside for a moment and also set it aside that I find it borderline implausible that he was able to do this without getting caught. And of course, you know, that people didn't say, hey, my salad tastes gritty, or hey, this appears to not be a potato piece in my soup. It appears to be a hard little oval-shaped pill. You get my point. It's so implausible to me. But let's just put all that aside. So think about it. You're deep in sleep and there's a first blast and it's not as if it's right beside you. So it doesn't quite register. Then comes the second blast. Now maybe you stir a little bit, but you're groggy and you're not sure if it was part of a dream. Then he kills the brothers. And again, if you're the sisters, maybe now you're kind of starting to come out of it, that groggy state, and wake up. But you start making mental excuses, like a car backfired. And then by that point, Butch is in your room. This did not drag out. And when they found the weapon, yes, it was a rifle, as they determined, of that caliber. And it was a lever action, which in my experience are wicked fast to work. I personally have more trouble doing a pump action. So that's one option that I find believable. Let me say something else, though. It has to do with what Tiff picked up on, how they were all face down in the beds. I've seen the photos. They are face down, smushed faces into pillows. Maybe some were kind of to the side, but it's slight. I mean, you'd be suffocating yourself, and your autonomic reflexes aren't going to allow you to do that. Still, put that aside for a second. I know we're putting a lot aside. I'm just trying to give every angle consideration. Not everybody sleeps on their bellies, and I find it statistically weird that 6 people all slept this way, much less with their arms above their heads. So perhaps he did find some of the kids awake and out of bed, maybe hiding, and he told them to get back in bed and lay face down so he wouldn't have to look at them. I think he told them all to lay face down. You're half awake, he's got a gun on you, and what else are you going to do? And last thing on the noise, just so as you know, these bedrooms were spread out over 2 and 3 floors, so you've got that extra distance as well. This just is not some, oh my God, deal for me. And Lord help us, them potentially not hearing anything and remaining in deep sleep is certainly not due to some kind of paranormal intervention. I think he woke up the parents and he told them to lay like that, went to the kids. If they weren't already awake, he woke them up and told them to lay like that as well. Oh, and P.S., another reason I think this, I read in part of the trial transcript that I was able to find that at least in Mr. DeFeo, the 2 bullets that struck him, they're at 2 different trajectories.
Oh.
Right? So they woke up on their own and or he woke them up. Come on.
Yeah.
Come on. I don't. And everybody's like, why didn't they wake up? Y'all, let's use some common sense here.
but somebody's got a gun on you, you're going to lay back down.
You're going to do whatever they say, jumping jacks. I'm going to do whatever they want me to do in the hopes that, or maybe I'm trying to talk them out of it while I'm doing it. You know, it just, they were awake and he purposefully had them lay that way. So, but in any event, the ME testified that toxicology-wise, they found no evidence that the family was drugged. Though, like I said, in one of my sources where he was interviewed by a reporter, he said at the time that he thought it would make sense. The thing is, again, the timeline here is just a mess in terms of time of death, and we don't know when they ate dinner. But my best guess is that if Butch had drugged them, it would have been decently metabolized by the time they drew the blood work. And I know fuck all about the sensitivity of lab tests back in the 70s, so you got me. From what I saw, even today, barbiturates are not part of a standard drug panel, and the sensitivity wildly varies depending on whether they were short-acting, intermediate, or long-acting. Time of last dose. Frequency of use. Are you testing urine, hair follicle, blood, saliva? There's just a litany of factors. And it just irritated me that I hear or see people being like, well, what the fuck is the ME's deal? Well, his deal is, the context of the interview was police had revealed that Butch had said he drugged the family. So the reporter asked the ME about it, asking for comment. ME's like, I can't tell you for sure because my toxicology hadn't come back, but I guess that makes sense if nobody woke up. But by the time of the trial, guess what? The toxicology had come back. It indicated no trace of sleepy night-nights, so that was his testimony. There is no weirdness here. There's no conflict here. Okay, here's what else comes out about Butch, both in the police interviews and otherwise. He had a contentious relationship with his father, unsure if there were witnesses to this or if this was coming from Butch, but I'll buy it, and what I'm about to tell you next will give you a good idea as to probably why there was strain, to put it mildly. He had a criminal history of petty robbery. Friends told police that he was, quote, a gun fanatic. He regularly took heroin and LSD, and in one of my sources, it notes that Butch, quote, was under a special narcotics probation, was given 15 urine analysis tests between last June and last October, and two of these tests show traces of quinine. I looked this up, and apparently, because I have never done heroin, so I don't know, tonic water in which there is quinine is used in heroin preparation for injection. And unless you just downed a gin and tonic or 15 before you peed in the cup, well. So my suspicion is that, again, not familiar with 1970s lab testing sensitivity, is that if you screened for heroin, it's just going to kick out as an opiate. So that wouldn't really narrow it down. But let's also not discount fresh track marks. I think that would also be a raging clue. Next thing, he had been diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder, and I checked, and yes, this was a diagnosis in the DSM-2 as of 1968. And finally, that he heard voices. There's a big but on this one, though. Now, practically everywhere I read, it's claimed that Butch says he heard voices the night of the murders telling him to kill his family. Maybe he said that initially. I don't know. I don't have access to that 20-hour initial interview, those transcripts, if there are any. And besides, Butch says lots of things. What I do know is what's in the trial transcripts, what he testified to under oath. Question: on the night that you killed your family, did God tell you to do that? Answer: no, sir. Question: you heard no voices at that time, did you? Answer: the night it happened? Yes, Butch, keep up. Questioner: yes. Answer: I didn't hear no voices the night this happened. Question: how many times has God talked to you? Answer:
oh, it's God. Specifically, it's God, huh?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Answer: I don't know. Somebody is talking to me a lot. It's got to be God. That's all I got to say. Question: you feel you are an agent of God? Answer: yes, sir. Sometimes I did. And I'm going to jump ahead to at least one other time he has confirmed this, which is in a May 2000 letter. Quote: in Butch's own handwriting, he wrote, "It was cold-blooded murder, period. No ghosts, no demons." The letter was sent to a producer that Butch was trying to get to pay him money for an interview. He also said in an interview from jail, in relation to things he was going to assert for an appeal for a new trial, that in addition to accusing attorney Weber as being part of a conspiracy so that he could profit from the book and such, that more people were involved. And hang tight, we're getting there. And that after the murders, quote, he spent the day drinking and shooting heroin before returning and pretending to find the bodies. which, as you've heard, my understanding is that it was confirmed that he was at work. I don't know if they meant like he went to work, cut out early, spent a good chunk of time at the bar to put on that whole act of, oh, I can't get anybody to pick up at the house. But back to the original trial. So was it that he was on drugs, or was there an underlying psychiatric condition? A little bit of both. Is he full of shit? Nah. They do go for a defense of insanity, and they did have a psychiatrist to testify to such. Other places noted that he also behaved really weirdly throughout the trial. I didn't go digging for specifics, but one source said, quote, he even threatened to kill the judge and his own lawyer. More on the subject of his defense, one thing that comes up is the suggestion that Ronald would get violent. Quote, with an abusive father and passive mother, the boy's troubled childhood led to substance abuse as an adult. He not only lashed out at his father, but once even threatened him with a gun. The parents hoped letting him live at home and with a weekly stipend would help because he could barely hold a job. But amongst others, there's one person I'm going to single out as denying this, and that is the DeFeo's next-door neighbor, Patrick O'Reilly, who I mentioned earlier. He was a kid at the time and was friends with their kids, and he spent a lot of time at the house. He was practically a member of the family. He describes the DeFeo parents as, quote, really nice, loving people who treated everyone wonderfully. Everyone who came to the house, they treated everyone the same way. And in the documentary I watched, which is linked for you in show notes, of course, he is visibly upset when he talked about learning of the murders. He was quite close to this family. So he vehemently denies this suggestion, and he was around this family near constantly, so a pretty good source. Having said that, of course, we need to remember that things like that can be hidden until, you know, somebody dies. And yes, it happens that abusers will zero in on just one or maybe a few family members and leave the rest alone. But again, there is no evidence of this. Another thing that comes up is that supposedly Butch had discovered his mother was having an affair. No corroborating evidence has ever come out to support this either. And there's also a multitude of things that Butch asserted then and throughout the years, such as that he was actually married and his brother-in-law was with him that night, and about whom, quote, the district attorney's office said its research has turned up no such person, and it suggests he does not exist.
Imagine that.
Imagine that. And if I was reading correctly, I didn't go down this road, but if I was reading correctly, I think that the woman did exist, but I don't know if it was like a common law marriage or if they were separated or whatever, because she's living either in New York City or possibly New Jersey or somewhere else in Long Island. I didn't write it down again because I did not go down that road because it wasn't pertinent. But this part is pertinent, you know, that this brother-in-law doesn't exist. And I imagine the easiest way to determine that was to go to her and say, hey, do you have a brother? Anyway. And other things, that his mother had called him to intervene on a fight the father was having with oldest daughter Dawn over a boyfriend. Then, no, Dawn had actually done some killing. Then, no, it was him and Dawn and two of Dawn's friends. No, it was him and the brother-in-law and two of Dawn's friends. Then, no, he killed Dawn. Then Dawn killed the others. Just over and over and over again, the story has kept changing, or details kept changing, or details were added. We would be here all day if I went into them. You will find places that suggest that Dawn had been killed elsewhere, that there was blood spatter on floorboards outside of the bedrooms. How do we know that if we don't have full access to all the reports? Then that people testified that they found it impossible one person could have done this. Well, great. I bet there's also people who find it possible. Like, hey, me, I find it possible. So is my testimony worth more than, like, that's an opinion. That's not a scientific, that's a guess.
Yeah.
One place said that they had tested that this rifle could be heard like a mile away. That does not sound scientific to me. You would have to have records of each person's hearing.
Right.
You would have to know if maybe they slept like all snugged up with the pillow over their head. You would have to know if they wore earplugs.
You have to account for stuff in the house too that's going to absorb sound. That's going to, like, I don't, there's just no.
Right. So
I don't know.
There's no possible way to know this. I don't even know why this was entertained, but. And here's my thing. I'm not going to put all this conspiracy theory-esque stuff out here because I couldn't trace it back to original sources. Some articles and websites are beautifully done, but they're just not citing their sources, or at least sources beyond Butch. So I'm not taking it as undisputed fact. There are a couple websites that I'll link you to that have just treasure troves of old news articles that they've scanned in, as well as the evidence file, well, at least part of it, and a smattering of trial transcripts, just various bits and bobs. But y'all, I simply did not have time to go through everything, and we don't have access to all of the reports and transcripts and testimonies and all that, and we need to move on. As for the prosecution, their psychiatrist, quote, maintained that although DeFeo was a user of heroin and LSD and he had antisocial personality disorder, he was aware of his actions at the time of the crime. And as for motive, the prosecution tells the jury about how he'd asked about how to collect the life insurance. On November 21, 1975, Butch is found guilty of 6 counts of second-degree murder and later was sentenced to 6 counts of 25 to life. For our non-U.S. residents, here's what the distinction is. It's that first degree requires premeditation, so in other words, planning. It's done on purpose. And the second degree is that, yes, it was also done on purpose. There was intent, just like in first, but it happened in something like a heat of the moment kind of way, which, not a lawyer, but I think it was first degree murder. Maybe they did too, but they just didn't have the evidence to back it up. But I think it was calculated. Unless there's family members or friends or doctors who come forward to confirm that Butch had a history of hearing voices. And yes, he's around that sweet spot age-wise when schizophrenia often kicks in for people. I am going to stop and note, though, you can have a perfectly livable life if you have schizophrenia, even if you're having auditory and visual hallucinations. There are ways to mitigate that. We can talk about that at some point if y'all are interested. I have great stories from when I did my psych rotation. I have a relative that has, I think, auditory. I'm pretty sure it's auditory. And she needs help with some stuff, but she lives out in society. So schizophrenia is not a straight line to killing people.
No.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but has he continued with having those issues since he's been in jail?
No, everything I saw documented, Butch has denied it.
Oh, so it just happened then?
Right. So it just occasionally happened before the murders, didn't happen during the murders, and nothing that I saw indicated that he said that he is hearing this in jail. For all we know, he's got mandatory counseling or medication or something. I mean,
right.
I just don't know. But I think that at least, I think it was planned because, like I said earlier, being at the bar, making a big deal, getting no answer. I mean, you know, being at the bar in the first place to make sure he was sane. And then coming back versus going to a neighbor's or something, that just, to me, it sounds like he's...
Hey, guys, remember when I left? Remember when I was not here?
Right.
Just, yeah.
Because perhaps he was not knowledgeable enough to know that, oh, you know, and I was at work, remember? Because you can see my timestamp card or whatever. I think he just probably wasn't knowledgeable about how doctors determine time of death. And so he was creating this whole alibi thing.
Mm-hmm.
And also making sure people saw him hysterical. So I think he was in his right mind. And securing the dog. That's another thing. Securing the dog so it wouldn't be a hassle. That too. And perhaps he thought he was making it look like a mob killing, like execution style. I simply don't know. Going back briefly to his attorney, Weber, we already talked about during the whole ghosty part how the Lutzes had gone to Weber with the haunted house angle. And it sounded like Weber was maybe going to do something with it at first. But check this out. At the press conference with the Lutzes, Weber had said, quote, he was looking into filing a motion, though he never said what kind, and none appears to have ever been filed. And like we talked about, Weber never bought into the haunting stuff being for real. He freely admits that he just liked it for book purposes. He did go for that insanity defense, though, that's true, but Weber apparently later said that Butch hadn't wanted to, as, quote, DeFeo later corroborated Weber's account, saying he'd never wanted to claim insanity. So, you know, do extremely mentally ill people think they're mentally ill? No, not typically. Not without serious therapy do they come to accept they need consistent counseling and medication, perhaps an occasional inpatient stay, maybe some outpatient occupational therapy, a family member to come by and help them do bills, or et cetera, ad nauseum. That takes time. What's the old, I don't know if it's an official adage or a saying, but it's something that I've always heard and thought, yeah, if you ask yourself, am I crazy? Chances are you're not, because you're cognizant enough to, you know what I mean?
To question it, yeah. And I mean, if he was a substance abuser, if he was a drug user, that definitely messes with your mental state. I can see there being some issues there and maybe not a full grasp on reality.
Decision making.
Right.
God, y'all don't quote me. Well, of course, I think everybody knows this. Long-term drug abuse does ultimately damage the brain. You know, the brain's not going to rebound back to square one every time you don't take a dose. I mean, habitual drug use will do this. And I think it might be the logic areas, you know, the area of the brain surrounding logic, decision-making, impulsivity. But you're exactly right. You're exactly right that the drug, and I'd have to look up heroin. The LSD, though, in particular.
Yeah, that'll do a number on your perception of reality.
Anything in that vein, LSD, PCP, mushrooms, ayahuasca, just, you get weird, really has a hallucinogenic effect. And there's nothing to be done. There's, you know, you can give Narcan to reverse certain drugs. And my God, I've got stories about that too. You want to talk about somebody sitting right up in bed? That stuff is just a godsend for a person who's ODing. Doesn't work on all drugs, but works on a good chunk. And there's nothing to be done about these hallucinogenic type drugs. I got stories about that too. You put them on an IV, you know, because they're probably dehydrated. God knows the last time they drank something or ate something or whatever. But they get brought in because the friends of the family just don't know what else to do with them while they're coming down off the high. And the emergency, we can't do anything in the emergency department. I get it's an emergency to you, but it's not actually an emergency. So you park them in a room. You put them on a monitor for kicks and you give them a cold rag and you turn the TV off so that they're not freaking out about that. You hopefully have them in a room that's close to somebody's desk so that they can have one eye on them because they will try to climb out of the bed, over the bed, like, or ooze out of the bed. So, yeah, there's nothing to be done. It just has to wear off.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the bottom line with that. And I do want to reiterate, people with antisocial personality disorders, much like schizophrenics, unless it is a severe case of schizophrenia, but people with antisocial personality disorders can live their lives in society without going around murdering people. To be sure, there's likely difficulty at times relating to others and whatnot, but they're not blowing people away in their beds in the middle of the night. So that part, I'm with you. I'll buy the hallucinating his balls off on LSD before I'll pin it on antisocial personality disorder. That, to me, contributes more to if he had a contentious relationship with his parents, that day-to-day type stuff, or if he had, you know, having trouble keeping a job. That, to me, well, of course, in the heroin, but that plays more into it to me than relating that to being a murderer. Not at all. Uh-uh. Bottom line. All his appeals and parole board appearances to date, as of November 2020, have been denied, and he remains at the Sullivan Correctional Facility in Fallsville, New York. So, I hope I've helped to clear up some of the stuff that commonly pops up when you do a cursory look into this case, because there's pieces of it that just aren't some great mystery to me. There's not huge controversy. There's not... It makes sense to me, as much sense as something like this can make. I get it. He's a messed up dude and he killed his family. And
yeah,
I get why it did not appear that anybody woke up, but I think they were awake and he told them to lay like that. I'm a very Occam's razor type of girl. If six people of varying ages, different across the board, the only thing they have in common is that they're blood related, all laying on their stomachs, all with their hands or arms, whatever, above their heads. I'm sorry. They were told to lay that way.
Yeah, that was definitely, and, you know, especially with them being, like, face down, smushed into the pillow.
Exactly. Could he have posed them that way? Yeah, I guess. There was nothing mentioned that there was evidence that they were posed. After the fact, I mean. Because you can tell just by blood spatter against the headboard and all that stuff. You can tell if somebody, say, moved the head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's it. That's your story of the Amityville horror, the murder part, and the ghosty part. I don't buy into a lot of either, as you can tell. Well, I buy into nothing about the latter, but there's a lot of holes in the commonly touted facts, quote unquote, for the DeFeo end of it.
Like Swiss cheese.
It's a bit Swiss cheesy. But Jody, the demon pig for the win.
Oh, definitely.
We would adopt little Jody.
We stan a demon pig. And we stan.
Stan, what a... Oh, God. Stan, maybe it's Stan's pet. He just sent her up there just to fuck with people. That's up Stan's alley. See, that's how Stan works. Stan doesn't possess you. Stan's got other things to do. And that's your story. What do we think?
As far as what? I think both the stories are bullshit. Is that what you're asking?
That concludes this episode. And all right. Keep listening. No, seriously, I'm dead serious. That's it. That's really, I concur. And it's all hooey. And it's worth, I guess the take-home lesson is always more than meets the eye. Don't assume that you're hearing the gospel truth, even when something is touted as being true. I don't know. That's the stupidest lesson ever. Of course, that's the lesson. That's common sense. I'm going to edit every bit of this out. I'm done. All right. Keep listening so you can hear how to get a hold of us. That's what the outro is going to be. It tells you the email, the blog where you can find show notes and sources and all that good stuff and the social medias and all that. And that's it. The next episode is going to be the Christmas episode and it's going to be a hoot. I can tell you that already.
We're going to have fun for sure.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, are you going to say it? This is where the catchphrase goes. Oh, I'm going to say it. This is where the catchphrase goes.
You snuck it in there. All right. Bye, guys.
Thanks so much for listening. As a reminder, you can check out our sources for each of the episodes at show notes, along with any supplemental things we think you might enjoy.
Visit us on our blog at youtotallymadethatup.tumblr.com. You can also find us on Twitter at YTMTUpodcast and on Instagram at youtotallymadethatup. Feel free to contact us on those platforms, and you can also email us. That address is youtotallymadethatup@gmail.com.